poet Phyllis Becker uses the legacy of Kansas City jazz along with her understanding of human nature to illuminate her work and acknowledges her love for experimenting with poetic forms.
I find them a challenge because how do you take a form and make it sound new and fresh and modern? So I like to use form poems and use an unexpected topic with it.
From Urban Sonnet to Prayers, the poems of Phyllis Becker's book, How I Came to Love Jazz, inform us of her world. We'll also find out how a couple of her poems were set to music by jazz vocalist Angela Hagenbach. We're hearing music from that CD now, but we'll listen to one of the poems later. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine that ushered in 2017 with a jazz issue, including new work by Phyllis Becker and others. I'm Angela Elam at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. It's no wonder Phyllis Becker is drawn to jazz. After all, her father, Dr. Leslie Becker, was an elder statesman of Kansas City jazz. He passed away in July 2016 at the age of 93, but was still actively promoting the music tradition of this city when I interviewed his daughter in 2010. She's also an active promoter, but of the literary arts, through the Riverfront Reading Series and the Writer's Place. The author of the chapbook, Walking Naked into Sunday, her first full-length book of poetry fits nicely with the jazz issue of our magazine, so we thought we'd revisit her work. Here's Phyllis Becker with the title poem of that collection in honor of her parents.
How I Came to Love Jazz for Tony and Les. My mom and dad met when she was 13, he's 16. They lived in Brooklyn. She was friends with his sister, Nell, and he became friends with her brother, Jack. Dad played the violin, had to go past Sarah Vaughn and her gang on his way to lessons, and they chased him because he played the violin, so he quit. Uncle Jack introduced Dad to bebop. It was still new then and denounced as devil music. Coltrane, Byrd, Monk. He couldn't understand it all, but couldn't stop listening. My mother was fair with long, almost black hair. Dad and his friends used to call her Snowy with Blowy. In those days, my darker-skinned dad couldn't pass the brown paper bag rule, but Mother didn't care about that. She took dance lessons from Lena Horne, just a young girl in the neighborhood making a living. Aunt Nell took classes from Catherine Dunham. Mom's friend dated Harry Belafonte, but she married someone else. Dad took my mother to Coney Island and jazz clubs, where she drank only milk, and he taught her about jazz and how to smoke cigarettes.
That's the title poem from the collection, How I Came to Love Jazz, by Phyllis Becker. And it gives us a glimpse into the lives of her parents. How did you guys end up in Kansas City? Was it jazz that drew you to this area?
No, my dad is a physician, and the Army paid for his medical schooling. And so as a part of his service, he had to practice at VA centers. I have four brothers and sisters, and each of us was born in a different place at a different VA center. So we ended up in Kansas City. My youngest sister was born in Leavenworth. That was his last VA center. Then he opened up a private practice in Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas.
And decided to plant himself
here. Yes. He's very happy to be here in Kansas City because we have a great jazz scene here. I grew up hearing jazz and listening to jazz. It was always in the background, but I was listening to what was popular.
Of course.
And it wasn't till I was in my 20s and I came back home from Howard and, you know, we started going out and there was lots of jazz clubs. So you'd end up going to jazz and I'd sit there and I was like, God, I know that music. You know, oh, wow, I like this music. It grew on me, you know, outside my awareness. And so now I just love jazz.
It's interesting to me, too, because when I first read that poem, I was like, well, she doesn't really tell me how she came to love jazz in the poem. But I realized as, you know, I went past it and I was reading other things that it became inherent in you in some way.
Yes.
And that was your point, I think.
Yes, it was.
There's another poem in here that gives us a sense of the time when you were growing up and also a look into your family, but into a bigger place where you fit into society. And it's called the National Medical Association Convention, Philadelphia, 1972. And I thought I'd have you read that.
The National Medical Association Convention, Philadelphia, 1972. Our folks did not know it, but the fast group my brother and I ran with shunned the children's activities of the NMA, a convention of black doctors. The NMA was created by men like my father in response to their exclusion from the AMA, hospital staff positions, and other medical societies. I was 15, tall and skinny, and barely fit in with the sophisticated young group from LA, New York, and Boston. But I had a fine brother and all the girls wanted to meet. I watched from the sidelines as they partied like Soul Train and bragged about their 240Zs they got for their sweet 16s. We were rich to our cousins and neighbors, but my mother still darned our socks, collected coupons, and never got over leaving Brooklyn for the suburbs of the Midwest. At the convention in the city of brotherly love, we cared little of our parents' long climb and paid them back by running the streets, money burning holes in our pockets as we ditched the carefully planned tours. We got tickets to see James Brown, and though some of the group thought James was tacky, we went anyway. I lagged behind the others as they paired off into couples. Inside the club, the musicians started to blow, their horns, lights flashed, the crowd screamed, and somehow I ended up on top of the table, clapping and singing, "I got soul and I'm super bad. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud and I feel good." I was bumping and bouncing with the crowd, and James Brown was splitting and sweating and falling to the ground, and I don't know where my friends went or my brother as I danced into the night in the birthplace of America, the cradle of liberty, city of freedom.
The National Medical Association Convention, Philadelphia, 1972. That's such a sedate title for a poem that, you know, gets rowdy in the end. I'm talking to Phyllis Becker today for New Letters on the Air, and her book of poems is called How I Came to Love Jazz. There is a poem that gives some of your background, which, you know, I think is such an American story, and it's called Luck of the Irish. So I thought I'd have you read that.
Luck of the Irish. She married the family's black servant shortly after coming over on the boat, potato famine and all. I look at the picture my mother, her great-great-granddaughter, gave me. It's the only one of her before she got married. Her four brothers stand stiffly beside her. They look disapproving even then. I try to find the resemblance, see none, except the freckles and the glazed look in her eyes. I never claim her except on St. Pat's Day, just to make fun when someone inevitably asks who has Irish blood. In grade schools, the teachers never believe me when I raise my hand. Even now, when I tell my friends with names like Grady and O'Brien we might be related, they give me blank stares, as if wondering where I came from, or maybe where they did.
I think that's so interesting because it's everything that you always know. I mean, you were raised as black, but you obviously have other, we were talking before we started this interview that one of your ancestors was
Narragansett Indians.
Yeah. You know, this whole idea that there are a lot of people that are related to each other,
yeah.
You know, whether we admit it or not.
Especially with all the things they can do with DNA now. You know, it's very interesting. If anybody does the little test you can do, you can find out exactly where you are in the mix.
Have you done the test yet?
I didn't. My parents did it, though.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So what did they discover? And any surprises?
Yeah, it was funny. It was interesting. My dad was, and I'm not going to get it exactly right, but he was like 46% from Sub-Saharan Africa. Then like another 8%, which was the Indian. And then the other percentage was European. So that was his mix. And then my mother was exactly 50-50.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
African and
European.
European.
And
Northern European.
And her ancestor was the Irish woman.
Yeah.
But in the same family, it doesn't come up the same because my uncle's, my dad's brothers was different, and my aunt, his sister, it was a little different of a mix, you know. So we're all, I just can't imagine anybody's not a little bit of something.
That's
and we
I'm
all come from Africa, so.
That's right. It
Mother
all
Africa.
Comes from the same place.
Yep.
Well, you actually have a poem that kind of deals with the DNA thing. And I thought this would be interesting because we're airing this interview during Black History Month. So I thought I'd have you read Sally Hemings Gets the Last Laugh.
Okay. Sally Hemings Gets the Last Laugh. And this begins with a quote from the State News Service, November 3rd, 1998. Family descended from Jefferson's slave. Well, I'll be. It's taken some fandangled test of the 21st century to prove what we knew all along. Master slipping into slave quarters was nothing new. And now you folks damn him, defend him, justify him. Facts are facts. No use in prettying them up. It is a shame, but just as in my time, you got it right for all the wrong reasons. Whoever said knowing is understanding, understanding is believing, believing changes lives. You still haven't learned public lives, private lies. Some things just don't change. But don't hang your head. It's still true. All men are created equal. And at the break of dawn, when he would sneak out from my bed, unlike me, free to come and go, what he couldn't see, like some of you, is what he learned from me, that for all his liberties, he wasn't free.
For all his liberties, he wasn't free. That's such a gripping story in history anyway, because I guess Sally Hemings was actually the half-sister of Thomas Jefferson's wife who had died.
Right.
So you can imagine they must have looked something alike, too.
Yeah. As we learn more and more about this, it's funny to me because we all really did know, but it still somehow feels shocking to some people to get the actual details, but I just think it's an important part of our history we really just need to pay attention to.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly.
And, you know, just shifts your idea about who we are and how we are in this world.
So I'm curious to know about your beginnings as a poet and what first drove you to write poetry.
We have a very strong artistic streak in my family and really a tradition of having work in the helping fields and having some kind of artistic part of your life, too, that's real strong.
That sounds so healthy.
It is, but it's hard to juggle sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a sister who's a teacher, who's a visual artist, another sister who's a nurse and a dancer. And I actually started out as a dancer.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
A modern dance, jazz?
Modern and ballet. I was on the Kansas City Ballet back in the day, and I also danced with Black Exodus, which was a group out of UMKC. Through the Black Student Union. I did that when I was a teenager. But also while I was in high school, I took some writing classes and had really, really good English teachers. So in our school, we did lots of fun things around our classes. I can remember very clearly we had to act out poetry one year for one of our classes. And so that's how I discovered Gwendolyn Brooks. Loved her poetry. I was very much into the whole Black artist during the 60s. And so that's kind of where I started. And when I got back home to Kansas City and started working back in social work.
Because I should say you went to college at Howard University back east.
Yes. Yeah. And when I came back home and got a job in youth services, it's very, very intense work and it requires a great deal of commitment. And I really couldn't see dancing and doing that at the same time. And I'm like, but I got to do something. So I was like, I like writing. So I started taking classes. I grew up in Wyandotte County, started taking classes at the community college where Phil Miller was teaching.
And Okay.
And Phil's a pretty hands-on teacher. He really wants you to write and write well. And he really helped me quite a bit in my writing.
Well, for people who are outside of the Kansas City area, they might not realize that Phil Miller was a big mover and shaker here in Kansas City for the poetry scene for a while because he started the Riverfront Readings.
Yes.
And you're now guiding that. Is that right?
Yes. I'm the coordinator for that with my committee. I always say it takes like six of us to do what Phil did, you know, what one person did. He had so much energy.
Being a part of the Riverfront reading series, I mean, how did that inspire you to help others?
Well, Riverfront has given a lot of people who may not otherwise get a reading because they may not be through the traditional ways of getting readings or in the academic
They may not have books
track
published yet.
And so it really offers that opportunity, offered me that opportunity. Feels nice to give other writers that opportunity.
Yeah, to give back a little bit. The writer's place. Tell me about the connection between those two things.
Riverfront has a long association with the writer's place. We supported Phil in the Riverfront, but, you know, he did the Lions work on it. And when he left, he was on the board of the writer's place as well. And the writer's place had some student outreach programs. And so I was involved in those as well. So it kind of all came together. And then I ended up on the board.
When Gloria Vando first had the idea, I remember reading this, that she was really inspired by the Poets' House in New York City. That's kind of what she was aiming for. Mm-hmm. And it really is to not only be a place where people can do readings, but it's a place to gather for other things. There's art involved. Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about what the Writer's Place tries to do.
Well, we have several programs. We have several reading series. Then we also have workshops, and then we have our outreach programs. So, for example, now we're back into the schools where we send writers into the schools and work with kids about writing, you know, fiction, poetry, whatever. So we're really just trying to promote literature and get people involved in literature and also provide avenues for people to share their works or listen to works that may not have a place to do that otherwise.
Right. And how does this tie into your day job? Or does it at all? Is there any cross-pollination?
Well, in some ways, there's some crossover. My work with the outreach is with youth. And so I'm very comfortable working with youth, working with people who work with kids. And that's all from my social work background and my work with the Division of Youth Services. My work grounds me. And so I feel like that helps me in my work in literature, because you can kind of go off track. If I only did that, I don't think my poetry would be as good, you know, for me. Now, although I'm always whining because I don't have enough time to write, but that's something I'll have to figure out how to do. You know, I keep that up pretty well.
Yeah. Well, there's a section in your book dealing with some difficult things. For instance, there's a poem that's titled I Wasn't Raped, but there's obviously there's a section of poems that deal with being violated, whether it's rape or being attacked. And it would seem to me with the kind of work that you do that you're dealing with these kind of issues often.
Yes.
And I thought maybe what I'll do is get you to read these two poems that come right next to each other in the book. Her Thoughts Lay in Wait, and then I Wasn't Raped.
Her Thoughts Lay in Wait. Thoughts about what happened would come to her at strange times. Never when everyone thought they would or should. Say, for example, when someone talked about a rape, mugging, assault they heard about on TV, or a close call someone they knew experienced. She really didn't think about it then. Those thoughts waited to come when she least expected them, like in between dragging on a cigarette and sipping a drink, walking down a hall, talking casually to a friend, in a restaurant, riding in a car, after work when she got home. They would sneak up on her and catch her by surprise, like he did.
That's Phyllis Becker. You know what I like what you do in that poem, that you capture that moment that is so true. When something really happens to us, we gird ourselves against being emotionally moved. So if somebody mentions a rape or being attacked or whatever, you know you're going to react, so you're strong. And it's the little things that catch you off guard.
Yeah, and I really wanted to reveal how a person might process a situation like that. And it's just the little things. It's not the big things. It's the little things that will trigger a person.
Well, they catch you by surprise. Yeah. That's exactly what happens.
Right, so. And then the kind of the whole traumatic piece of it that you remember afterwards, but you don't know. You might not know that until somebody says or does something.
Right.
So I wanted to capture that.
Well, let's hear that second one that follows.
I wasn't raped. Everyone told me how lucky I was. The policeman who closed the file, my friends, family, my boyfriend who was very relieved, and the social worker who wrote down the details, the insurance man who took my claims, the parking lot attendant who worked the evening shift, even the guy who did it would have agreed, because he kept telling me how lucky I was. He wasn't that type, not the kind of guy who raped women. He grabbed them, only jerked them around if they weren't still, looked at, touched their bodies, for kicks. Just enough, he said, to get off. Been doing it for years. So now when I think or talk about it, which isn't much lately, I always remind myself how lucky it was I didn't get raped.
I couldn't help but think how ironic that is, because whether you're raped or not, once you've been attacked, it's still such an intrusion that you live in a bit of fear, mm-hmm. Afterwards. It takes away something from you.
Yes.
To be violated, whether it's sexually or not.
So. Right. And then, kind of the irony of it all, it doesn't matter. There's lots of ways people get violated in this world, and it feels like rape.
Yeah. I Wasn't Raped. That's in the collection How I Came to Love Jazz by Phyllis Becker. Well, let's turn to more pleasant things.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. One of the things that keeps coming up in your poems and that we didn't touch on is gardening and, mm-hmm. Things growing. Seeds. I'm going to have you read that.
Okay. Seeds. Anticipating spring, I plant tomato and herb seeds indoors. It's February. My father is turning 75. Hands and dirt feel good. He and I have paid the price for a hard blossoming piece. I water the seeds every day. It's cold. The neighbors are fighting. Violence is a family value as old as the Bible, as present as our thoughts. A seedling breaks through dirt. There's a battle in the garden. Cat, squirrel, blue jays. The cat stalks through the vegetable patch filled with ripe tomatoes and greens. He crouches among rocks and ivy and waits. Patience pays off. Pigeon feathers flutter on ferns. I talk to my mother on the cordless phone as I water the garden. She's having a good day. I pinch the dead heads off the cosmos daisy. A lily bloom floats in a cup of water on my desk. The lush lilies and begonias, the scent of mint and sage, are memories now. Brittle leaves blow across garden beds. I pull, prune, make piles. These small acts of destruction satisfy.
That's the poem Seeds from the book How I Came to Love Jazz, poems by Phyllis Becker. I like that particular poem because what you do with the garden is also, in a way, what you have to do with the act of writing poetry, too. Mm-hmm. You're planting things, and then you're pruning them, and then you're having to get rid of parts of them. I just couldn't help but think about that. And I could tell, because gardening comes up in several of your poems in
Yes.
this book, that it means something to you. And to me, those two things, poetry and gardening, go hand in hand. Yeah. I don't know why that is.
But I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's very interesting. And you're right. You do, when you write, you're constantly editing and getting ideas and then figuring out what works and what doesn't.
It's a very similar type activity on some levels, if you like gardening, I guess.
But yeah, right.
Well, tell me a little bit, since we're talking about How I Came to Love Jazz, because sitting in front of me, too, is a CD by Angela Hagenbach, and she's a wonderful singer, and it's called Poetry of Love. And two of your poems are featured in this CD. How did you come about working with Angela?
As we mentioned earlier, my dad is a great supporter of jazz in the Kansas City community. And so he and my mother were good friends with Angela, followed her music. And so that's how I became friends with her. And she had some kind of assignment she needed to do where she had to use original lyrics. She said, I have music in my head. I don't necessarily have the lyrics. I said, well, I'll email you some poems. She said, great. So I did. And my husband did as well. And didn't hear from her, forgot about it. And like 3 or 4 months later, she said, well, I have it set to music. And we're like, wow. So that's how it got started. And it was just a really fun collaboration. It was wonderful to hear her interpretation of the poems, because I really literally sent her the poems. She never heard them read. She really hadn't read much of my stuff up until that point.
It is so intriguing to me, because when I read the poem in my head, I had such a different feeling about it. And then hearing her sing it, transformed the work into something else. It was really intriguing. So what I'm going to do right now is have you read the poem.
Okay.
And then we'll play her version of it.
Okay. Dark dreams. You tell me I'm the snake in your dreams. I vex you, uncurl, slither, and then strike. Hiss when I should purr, bite when I should lick. You fear my affections are deceptions and shudder at my smile, my dry, flaky touch. You wiggle and squirm to make your escape. Say I pull you down, bound to the ground. So I say you're right, but don't hesitate. Shed your old clothes anyway. Handle me, belly up, smooth and slick, tremble and twitch. You know I'm exactly what you wished. And while you rest, I'll slide behind your wakefulness, hibernate in cool dreams. Conjure me up whenever you need me.
Dark Dreams by Phyllis Becker from her book, How I Came to Love Jazz, published in 2008 by Helicon 9 Editions. I talked with her in 2010, and now she's one of several poets and writers included in the current jazz issue of New Letters magazine. We'll finish off with that promised rendition of her poem by the great Kansas City jazz vocalist, Angela Hagenbach. Here's Dark Dreams from the CD recording, Poetry of Love.
When I should lick, you fear my affections are deceptions and shudder at my smile, my dry, flaky touch, and you wiggle and you squirm to make your your old clothes anyway. Handle me, belly up, smooth and slick, tremble and twitch. You know I'm exactly what you wished. And while you rest, I will slide behind.
To find links to Angela Hagenbach's Poetry of Love recording or to the book How I Came to Love Jazz by Phyllis Becker, visit our website, newletters.org. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at New Letters Radio, a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Partial financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was originally produced with Dennis Conroe, Annie Walsh, Max Mosley, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.
I was slide behind your wakefulness, hibernates and cool dreams, conscious.